MSW Media.
Prevail, це щотижнева програма про політику.
L'histoire, la sécurité nationale.
Crimine organizzato, dinero sucio.
Глобальну корупцію та боротьбу за демократію.
E ora?
А тепер?
E maintenant?
Con ustedes, su anfitrión.
Grégoire.
Welcome to the fight. This time I know our side will win.
I'm Greg Oliar. This is Prevail. Welcome to the program. Please join me in thanking our new sponsor, America's number one meal kit, HelloFresh. Go to HelloFresh.com/50Prevail and use code 50Prevail for 50% off plus 15% off the next 2 months.
We've got a great show. Zarina Zabriskie is here. Zarina needs no introduction, but I'm going to give her one anyway. Right now, she is podcasting. She's doing interviews for Malcontent News. They have a great podcast. She's involved with that. She made a film with some other colleagues called Under Deadly Skies, a documentary about the war in Ukraine. She writes for the Byline Times. You can follow her work on the site formerly known as Twitter for as long as it lasts. And right now, she's one of only two journalists in Kherson, which is a city in southern Ukraine, sort of southern eastern Ukraine, on the mouth of the Dnipro River. And she's written about this for Prevail a couple times. She reported on it and told stories about Kherson when it was occupied by Russia. And then she wrote a great piece when it was liberated, because she was there when it was liberated. So what happened is that the Russians came in, they held it for 9 months, they were pushed back out across the river, and now they're going scorched earth on the place, which is what, you know, the Russians do. If they can't have anything, they want nobody to be able to have it, and they just try to destroy everything kind of indiscriminately. So this is a city that's, you know, it's the size of Pittsburgh, St. Louis, Lubbock, Texas. It's a mid-sized city. 280,000 people live there. And the Russians are trying to wipe it off the map. That's what they're trying to do, which they've done to other cities, you know, farther in the east, Mariupol and other places, just make it uninhabitable so that the people who are living there either leave or die and that there's nothing left. And Zarina is on hand. She's on the ground there. She's talking to people who live there and trying to get this word out to the rest of the world about what's happening and what the Russians are up to there, which is, you know, obviously horrifying. So as we talk about this in the interview, the geography is important, and I want to make sure that everybody kind of understands, because something that wasn't clear to me is that Kherson Oblast, which is sort of the larger place, kind of like, as she says in the interview, it's like New York City, New York State, right? Most of Kherson Oblast is on the other side of the river from where Kherson is proper. And the Russians are on that side of the river, not where the city is. So I think that's important in understanding kind of what's happening, because they're shelling the city from across the river. That's what's going on right now. So I wanted to have her on because it's important to shed light on what's happening in Ukraine, because I think we forget. Obviously, there's so much news going on, but it ties into everything. You know, it ties into everything that's happening right now here in the U.S. And we've had two big deals in the House of Representatives in the last couple weeks. There was the shutdown, or the, you know, the almost shutdown, where these asshole Republicans were trying to, you know, grind the government to a halt and refuse to sign these spending bills. Republicans in the Senate were okay with it, and it was the House and Kevin McCarthy that refused. And the main thing, ultimately, after all the dust was settled, is that they did not want any more money going to help Ukraine. That was the one thing that they demanded above all else. They didn't want any more aid to Ukraine. So when you listen to this podcast and to the interview with Zarina, and she talks about what the Russians are doing there, keep that in mind, because by not giving aid to Ukraine, these Republicans are basically siding with Putin, right? They're siding with Russia. They clearly want Russia to win. And They can say whatever they want. They can make excuses about it. Somebody like Rand Paul is always talking about peace. We need peace. Russia has invaded. So if there's a ceasefire or any attempt of peace, they're just going to keep the territory that they have right now. Why would Ukraine agree to that? Also, Putin doesn't pay any attention to treaties. He signs the treaties and then immediately violates them. You can't negotiate with somebody like that. So the only way that this war is going to end is if Russia just leaves. It's really that simple. It's always been that simple. The war is happening because Putin wants it to happen. And if he pulls back, the war will be over. It's that simple. The Republicans in Congress do not want the United States to continue helping Ukraine because they know that the Ukrainians will win. They will prevail if they have the proper aid. But what does that tell you? Now, Kevin McCarthy, because he wasn't extreme enough, has been vacated. That's the word that they're using, vacated. It sounds like, you know, voiding the bowels or something, right? He's vacated. And now there is no functional Speaker of the House. So the entire House of Representatives is in disarray, again, because of the Republicans and these. And why is it in disarray? Why are the Republicans mad? Because of the Ukraine aid piece. That's what it's all about. So, you know, who's the new Speaker of the House going to be? I don't know. But maybe they should just put Putin in there and eliminate the middleman. Because basically they're doing his work. And they have been for 7 years now, if not longer. And it's a disgrace. And again, when you listen to the interview and hear what's going on over there, this is behavior that Republicans are endorsing. This is what they're endorsing. A psychopath indiscriminately shelling apartment buildings, churches, hospitals, hotels, infrastructure that people need to live. Not soldiers, not military, regular people. They're trying to wipe a city off the face of the earth. That's what they're trying to do. And, you know, Matt Gaetz and Kevin McCarthy and these other Republicans obviously have no problem with that. They have no problem with it. So that's what they're about. They've told us what they're about. That's what they're about. And I just think it's awful and disgraceful. And I want people to make that connection that the only reason that shutdown happened is because of the Ukraine aid piece. And you have to ask, why was that so important to Kevin McCarthy, to Matt Gaetz, to Donald Trump? Why? Why were they helping Putin so much? I think we all know the answer. We'll be right back with Zarina Zabriskie.
Oh, McHenry's allowed and McCarthy was speaker. McCarthy is out and McHenry's the speaker. America waits because of Matt Gaetz, a loser and traitor who everyone hates. Oh, McHenry's allowed and McCarthy was speaker. McCarthy is out and McHenry's the speaker. America waits because of Matt Gaetz, a loser and traitor who everyone hates.
Zarina Zabriskie, welcome back to Prevail.
Hi. Hi, Greg. How are you doing?
I'm better than you, I'm sure. You're calling in. It's late at night where you are. You're in eastern Ukraine, somewhere in the area of Kherson.
It's actually southern Ukraine.
Okay.
And I'll be happy to tell you all the details of this unique geographical position because it is actually important.
It's funny you say that because I've drawn a map on my paper here and I was going to tell that to the listeners who don't know, you know, about the geography. And the more I think that we learn about Ukraine here in the United States, you know, I think the key to understanding it is to understand the geography. So Kherson is on the mouth kind of the Dnipro River, which kind of snakes upward and separates eastern Ukraine, which is kind of this bridge to Crimea. Right. It comes down into Crimea on the other side of the river.
Yes, this is absolutely true. But there is much more to this as one learns once one is here.
OK,
so I'd like to add to this description because you're absolutely right, Greg. The Dnipro River, which is the third largest river in Europe, starts in Russia as a very small rivulet, goes all the way through Belarus, and then exactly goes into the Black Sea. And Kherson is very close to the Black Sea
right
here on the Dnieper River. And the importance of this position cannot be underestimated. Because on the one hand, there is Crimea, the Crimean Peninsula, as most of us know, annexed by the Russian Federation in 2014. And the control over Kherson will directly influence who has control over Crimea. But on the other side, on the right bank of the river, as they call it, or the western one, where I am now, is sort of like a launch pad potential for the Russian Federation military to go to the critical seaports of Mykolaiv and Odessa, and as they have discussed in the beginning of the war, further on to the Russian proxy state in a way, Transnistria in Moldova, and from there, you know, the sky is the limit, because that goes all the way to Europe. But, well, let's not get too excited about it, but they definitely aimed for Mykolaiv and Odessa, that are critical seaports on the Black Sea.
Okay. Yeah, because I listened to your interview that you did on your podcast. What's the name of the podcast?
It's the Malcontent News. I started quite recently in September, and I think they're in the process of rebranding. So there will be some other name soon, but I don't know it yet. Okay. But for now, it's the Malcontent News, and they do very decent daily reports, sort of what I used to do for Euromaidan, but they have the whole team working on it, thankfully. So I don't do that. I'm taking a break from daily reviews, and I do interviews with all possible experts, interesting people, Ukrainian voices, experts on Ukraine, you name it.
So, yeah, I listened to the one you had Ben Hodges on, who was a retired U.S. general. That was pretty interesting. I went down this rabbit hole about Crimea lately. I interviewed someone from SIPA, who's from Crimea and is now studying it and reporting on the war and stuff, from Washington. And listen to your podcast, learning about it. And the consensus seems to be that Crimea is really what Russia wants, ultimately, where, you know, if to secure Crimea and make sure that they keep it is the most important thing to them, ultimately. Is that your sense as well? I know that's what Hodges said, but that appears to be. And if you look at the map, all the territories that they're in the process of either destroying or, you know, whatever they're doing, lead down to Crimea and seem to create a pathway from Russia to Crimea. So is that what you think is happening?
Yes. And you have to understand also, Greg, that we're talking about more of symbolic meaning than strategic.
Okay.
Because it's not like Russia doesn't have enough land.
Yeah.
It is literally the biggest country in the world. And as a person who traveled around this land, I can tell you that a big part of it is completely uninhabited and up for grabs. They don't experience the pressing need to have more lands. That is just not the case. The same goes for the natural resources. They have natural resources. They have gas and they have oil, as most people know in this world. And the Crimea is not going to offer any of this. However, Crimea has always been, and perhaps at least for now is, and might still be, what they call the jewel in the Russian Empire's crown. And I didn't come up with this brilliant description. I think my friend Phil Itner, journalist I know for many, many years, said, but maybe somebody else did. Anyway, it's going around. It's kind of archetypal. Because not one Russian ruler has managed to have any major gains, whether in terms of land or just victories in the war, and lose Crimea, because Crimea was always contested.
Yeah.
It's this wonderful land like a paradise. I used to spend a lot of time there as a kid because, remember, I had Ukrainian background. So my parents would take me first to Odessa. And when the Odessa family died, I spent a lot of summers in Crimea. And I know it very, very well. And it is really a paradise. It's amazingly beautiful. There are grapevines everywhere. They make wine and cognac. The sea is warm. There are dolphins. There's whatnot. It's very rich in history, in mythology, and many ethnicities live there and fight for it, you know, historically all the time. So for Russia, it has more of a symbolic meaning than anything else. Donbass is an entirely different story. It's a very impoverished place where the mines are not working anymore. Just more of a problem than a place. Russia wants it more of stubbornness than of anything else. It's a symbol of the Soviet period of the whole, you know, Russian empire history, right? And the Crimea is just this heavenly place that everybody always wanted. And Catherine the Great, who in many ways is a role model for Putin, who is from St. Petersburg. So Catherine the Great built a lot there, and she basically built the empire following into Peter the First steps. And that's what Putin wants. And that's why Crimea is so wanted. And what Ben Hodges was saying, and you're absolutely right about it, he's been saying it for a long time, for at least a year, that Crimea, being a peninsula, very easily could be turned into a trap. And when people speak about the slow counteroffensive, which is driving me crazy in a way, they don't take in consideration that it's really not about the inches of liberated soil that is oftentimes scorched, and we will be talking about it in a second, but it's about, say, destroying the logistical chains of supply for Russians. It's about destroying the Russian fleet. It's about destroying the Russian army so it cannot attack anymore. It's strategy, not just a computer game where little squares of land are being moved here and there. But the reason we talk about this geography is because Kherson is really of utmost critical strategic importance for the Russians, who in the very beginning of the war captured it, as you know.
Right.
That was the first major city that they seized practically without a battle, if you don't count the minor skirmishes with the territorial defense, because the Ukrainian army did not expect this move. They had to retreat. And there are a number of interesting stories that I'll be happy to share about what was happening here in the beginning of the war. But for those who are not familiar with Kherson, this city, very briefly, in a nutshell, what happened? The Russian army attacked, for most people, suddenly on the 24th of February 2022, moved across the river through Antonievsky Bridge and into Kherson. And after a week of chaos, Kherson was occupied by the Russians. The Russians established terror. They didn't expect any resistance. They thought that they would be greeted with flowers and bread and salt. They were not. There were these massive rallies of pro-Ukrainian anti-Russians. And so instead, the Russians established their terror and violence regime where people were arrested anywhere they went. Most people just stayed at home for no fault, for just looking at your phone, for whatever. There were at least four major torture chambers that were discovered after Kherson was liberated. People knew that their friends, their families were arrested, tortured, killed. There were all kind of horror stories going on there. I'm not going to go into that. And that was almost nine months of that. When in November, on November 11th, because of the brilliant move of the Ukrainian strategist, they distracted the Russians. They kept talking about the liberation of Kherson, and then instead they moved in the Kharkov direction. And so the Russians had to focus there and move their resources. And meanwhile, the Ukrainians moved and pushed them back in the Kharkov area, which is in the north, in the very north of Ukraine. And at the same time, they attacked and in Kherson in the south, and Russians had to retreat from across the river. And so it was a lot of joy. We discussed that. We talked about that. I was here in Kherson during the liberation. What happened then, immediately on the day of liberation, when Zelensky came to greet the city, the Russians started to shoot and shell and attack Kherson that very day. And they never stopped. And it accelerated and it accelerated and it accelerated. And what happened then in June, so we're talking from November till June, the city tried to recover, but they were killed by few people, civilians, every day. The buildings were destroyed. And then on June 6th, the Russians, as we now know, blew up the Novokakhovka Dam, right. Hydroelectric power dam. And there was a major flood that is now considered by many scientists and by the Ukrainian government environmental catastrophe and ecocide. And there was a major flood. Lots of people died, probably up in the hundreds. We don't know the numbers because on the left side, where the Russians are, they didn't disclose any numbers. They concealed the casualties. They were not letting rescuers and volunteers to the place where people were drowning. We only know of the victims and casualties on this side. A lot of people suffered. A lot of households were completely destroyed. The dam can be rebuilt. Now it's stated, and there was major damage to the environment. So that added to all the hardship that Kherson already had. Many people left, businesses closed with daily attacks. There've been closure every day, and there are no jobs, no money in the city. And we have arrived here 10 days ago, and just at the time, the attacks intensified to a somewhat unbelievably, almost ridiculous amount. I've never seen anything like this, and I've been in Ukraine for almost 2 years. There are explosions sometimes every 5 minutes, sometimes there's an hour of silence, and then they start again. And in the middle of September, the Russians started to drop air bombs on the city. And this is something else. I knew that air bombs were the worst because I was, they're called guided aerial bombs. Or here they're called Cubs. And when I was in Chernihiv Oblast, that's in the northeast reporting, I've visited those completely destroyed villages where the residents told me that nothing is worse than the aerial bomb because it's gigantic. It's like 500 kilograms of metal that is flying at you. You can't escape. It can't be intercepted. There's no air defense that can stop it. This is just, if it's flying at you, it's the end. And I've seen the results of it. I've seen the craters. And that's what the Russians started to do here because we're only in some places about 5 kilometers away across the river, sometimes more. And the river is covered with the reed beds on both sides, where people can hide very easily on both sides. So there's saboteurs on both sides. And at night you hear the Kalashnikovs, you hear machine guns, you hear mortar, and they use all of these smaller firearms, and they use artillery, heavy artillery, MLRS, Grad, which is an old Soviet one. Yesterday we found a Grad rocket made in 1962, Greg, in the Soviet Union. There was a stamp on it, and it completely destroyed a roof on the hotel, which was still somewhat operational. And they're targeting civilian places, critical infrastructure. Yesterday, we took a little tour of the newly destroyed places, and among them, there was a Ukrainian Orthodox church, a cathedral. Part of it was destroyed, and then another rocket went into the basement of an auxiliary building, and it didn't detonate. It was just sitting there as we were there. Like you could see through the big hole, you could see that. And there's not enough police to attend to all of this because it's happening everywhere all the time. And So there are cafes, there are stores, there are supermarkets. There would be a part of rocket of this grad sticking out from the pavement. I went to see the crater from the aerial bomb the other day. I have photographs on Twitter if somebody is more visual. And today, when I was writing an article about all of this, as I typed, Russians being in close proximity to, at this point, the walls shook and the doors opened because of the shockwave, because another aerial bomb was dropped in the neighborhood nearby, and there were 8 injured and 1 killed. And it's just ongoing. You hear at night, they do a lot of it at night because it's a psyop as well. They right. want to demoralize the population so we couldn't sleep. A lot of people adjust it and sleep, but a lot don't. And I usually sleep through anything. But last night I woke up because it was so loud. You hear the whistle, it goes like this. And you don't know where this dish will be.
Yeah.
As you listen for the second, as you're half asleep, and you think like, okay, there's a window right here. Should I just like go and locate, you know, like move under the bed? Or they say between two walls, the rule of two walls. Like, but at that point, you know, at 4:50 in the morning, it was the bathroom, which is the safest place, is so far and it's so dark, and all they want to do is just sleep. And it's like, oh, you, and you just go to bed. And so what I will say, and then I'll pass it back to you, they are doing here their scorched earth strategy. That's what the Russians have been doing way back in history. I actually looked it up, and they started it with in the war with Sweden. I actually forgot the date. You're a better historian than I am. I think it was in 1700s or 1800s. I think, yeah, 1700s, I'm pretty sure. And then obviously during the Napoleonic War, that's a very well-known right. accident happening. But because when Napoleon captured Moscow, it was empty and it was burning. And they were doing this to fight invaders, fair enough. You know, in World War I, they used it in some of the fronts. And then during World War II, when the Nazi Germany attacked, they used it a lot. But then they turned it around and they used it in Afghanistan. They used it in 2 Chechen wars. And most infamously, they used it in Syria, in Aleppo, and all the other places which they razed from the face of earth. And during the Ukrainian war of aggression, during the Russian war of aggression in Ukraine, rather, we know of a number of places. People heard about Mariupol in Donetsk Oblast. There are places like Severodonetsk, Popasna, Volnovakha, and many other, Avdiivka, Marinka, that don't exist anymore. And I've seen some of them. And I've seen these villages here in Kherson Oblast, which were already destroyed. And now they're doing it systematically. And what's worse, or what makes it worse, and what makes it even more of a hybrid war in the matter of geopolitics, is because it's not being reported. It's very hard to get a permit to be here for a foreign journalist. It takes a lot of time. And for those journalists who are not based here, like myself and my colleagues, it takes too long to wait. Most publications don't have that amount of money and don't have that much time, and they don't make it here. So all of this is happening in silence. The world is unaware. And I feel like this is my goal now, is to break the story through, to make the world see and hear. There's a big city that is being destroyed right now.
There's a lot to unpack with what you just said, and I want to go back and review a lot of the things you said so that it sticks for everybody listening and it sticks for me. Before we do, let's just get this out of the way. We have to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Zarina Zabriskie. So last week I came home from work and I'm thinking, what am I going to make for dinner? And I open the door and what's waiting for me in the vestibule but a package from HelloFresh. You know, I mean, when it comes to options for dinner, honestly, more is more. The HelloFresh menu includes 40 recipes and over 100 add-on items to choose from every week. I don't know if you're familiar with HelloFresh, but it has everything you need like right there. So all you have to do is open up the box and like start cooking. It's wonderful. In my case, I got these tacos, which the meat is so good that they have, and I put them with peppers and everything. And they gave me cabbage, and I was gonna make this cabbage, and I thought, I don't know if I like cabbage. I'm gonna try this, but I followed the recipe exactly. And these tacos were so good that I ate like 5 of them. Like I gorged myself on these delicious HelloFresh tacos. And now I learned how to cook them. I learned that, you know, cabbage is good. Who knew, right? You should totally try it. If you go to HelloFresh.com/50Prevail and use code 50Prevail, get 50% off plus 15% off the next 2 months. Kickstart a fresh fall routine with HelloFresh. HelloFresh handles all the meal planning and shopping to deliver everything you need to cook up a tasty meal right at home. They do the hard part and you get to take all the credit. You know, if you ever wish you can spend less time planning, shopping, cooking for the family, and more time with them, from easy time-saving breakfasts and family dinners to kid-approved lunches and snacks, HelloFresh has what it takes to keep everyone, including you, happy and satisfied. When you get HelloFresh, you know you're getting top-notch products since it travels from the farm to your door in less than 7 days. And I can attest this, the meat is like really good. You know, because sometimes you go to the store in your town and you buy the chopped meat and it's a little bit sus, as the kids say. Not here. This is like really good stuff, high quality stuff. You know, you don't have to go to the, sometimes I go to the supermarket and I buy things and then they wind up going bad because I don't know who's going to eat what. So this also eliminates that problem. It's just a wonderful thing. And I highly recommend it. I'm so delighted that they're sponsoring the show. I couldn't ask for a better sponsor. So I encourage you to try it. It's really great. Go to HelloFresh.com/50Prevail and use code 50Prevail for 50% off plus 15% off the next 2 months. HelloFresh. Delicious. It's really good. Try it. Trust me. Okay, we're back with Zarina Zabriskie. You are, and I can't remember if we said this up front, you're one of only 2 journalists in Kherson. So what you said before is, you know, this is a story that's gone unreported. Yeah, it's gone unreported because nobody's there. Other than people on the ground, you know, people that live there, there's nobody there. I remember with Mariupol, it was the same thing. There was one photographer left there and all of those images came from him. Kherson is a city that, I don't know what the population is, but before the invasion, the population was something on the order of 280,000 people, which means it's the same size roughly as St. Louis or Buffalo or Pittsburgh, St. Paul, Reno, Nevada, Lubbock, Texas. It's not a huge city, but it's big. It's not small. And there's a lot of people there. And there is no, it feels like, you know, what you said, the strategic importance of having that place helps the Russians with their ultimate goal, I think, of securing that jewel of the empire there with Crimea. But it doesn't feel like they're hitting military bases or anything like that. Their method, as you said, is just to destroy everything in sight, which they've done before and which you're watching happening. And, you know, as we discuss this, it is it's October 3rd. It's Tuesday afternoon. This is now a couple days from what happened in Nagorno-Karabakh, where the Azeris went in there. You know, to this place that had been contested where Armenians had been living for, I don't know, since the 90s, and basically, you know, ran them out. And 100,000 out of 120,000 Armenians just fled. And it feels like the Russians are hoping to do something similar here, just to hit all these places, make them uninhabitable so the people either die or just flee and get out of there. Do you think that's accurate, or is that, what is their purpose here? I mean, what, you know, they're blowing up stuff that they hope to one day control.
Well, first of all, that's a very good, as usual with you, Greg, analysis, but I wouldn't make this parallels with Nagorno-Karabakh because it's an entirely different area with very complicated, convoluted history. And as far as I know, and I'm definitely not an expert, in the 90s, Armenians actually came to live there. So there are different ways of looking at it, and I'm not going to do that.
I don't mean the ethnic stuff. I mean the military operation, which is just they're going to go in there and everyone's going to leave. It feels like that's what the Russians want in Kherson. Looking at it,
yeah. Well, hence goes the scorched earth strategy, because it's Russians didn't invent it. It's a military strategy which has been used by Scythians, you know, and by Romans. Mm-hmm. And it, what it does, it involves the deliberate destruction of virtually all resources of value to an enemy. And it could include vital resources like water, food, animals, vegetation, infrastructure, and it could be done. The strategy could be used either by an army that retreats and it leaves nothing valuable for the advancing enemy, like in Bakhmut, right? Before the Russians left, they completely destroyed it, or Mariinka. Or it could be used by an advancing army so it can counter the movement, you know, of the adversary. So, you know, if you cut the communication networks, blow up bridges, then electrical power stations are out. It's much harder to move along. And then, of course, the population is forced to move away. And then, as a result, there's nothing left there, nothing to contest, really. And it's like, in a more simple terms, like, if I can't have it, nobody will have it.
Yeah.
That sort of thing. And here in Kherson, it's very, very obvious, because they had it. The Russians had Kherson.
Right.
They had to leave. And in a way, it is also, it's a strategy, but it's also a revenge, because Russians are playing a very emotional, like, I don't know, psychopathic war here. So there's a lot of revenge and fury that goes into destruction of Kherson. And a part of it, frankly, is something that we just can't understand, because we are not psychopaths. We are not war criminals. We don't torture people in chambers. Why do they do it? I think there will be generations of psychologists who would be looking into it, and who would be looking into the real reasons, or rather causes of it.
Yeah. You know, but again, just to restate, this is a medium-sized city that is, you know, people live there. You know, families live there, children live there. There's places of business, there's houses of worship, and the Russians are just basically blowing up apartment buildings and churches and hospitals and hotels. And these are not military things; they're not military targets. It's just destruction and chaos for the sheer purpose of, you know, like you said, we don't know. We're not psychopaths, but to create fear and demoralize the people that live there, which, you know, I think in Ukraine, that strategy has not worked very well for the Russians. You know, every time that they hit, the Ukrainians seem to be more and more resolved and resolute in their, you know, desire to stand up for themselves, which is nice to see. I mean, where is this headed? Is this now the main target there? Are they really just going to keep doing this until it's completely destroyed like the other places? What do you think is going to happen? Like, can they move in defenses? Because I know that they're, you know, some of these countries in Europe are bringing things over. Now there's the new things that they're getting from Washington eventually that I forget what it's called, but it has the capability to fly, to send missiles further out than they're able to do now, basically into Crimea and the ports. You know, what's your sense?
Well, yes, it's a very difficult question. From what I understand from my interviews with military experts, from studying, you know, for my daily reviews, because I'm certainly not a military expert and I never will be, but I can just sum up what I heard from the good ones, and also based on what I see, just some common sense knowledge. The front line is extremely long. It's a very long front line. So the battle is going throughout this line.
Okay.
Everywhere. So it's almost like this alive being that it's always moving, and there's always something happening. So just looking at one tiny little piece is almost doing a disservice to what Ukrainian army is achieving here. like working on the counteroffensive. It's like, you know, it's like draw me a whale. I could draw just a little cartoon whale for a 3-year-old, but we will still know that there is like all this living being with cells and neurons and nervous system. That's pretty much how I feel. That's why I'm at loss for words, because I don't want to just simplify it terribly to this. But with Kherson, Russians, from everything I know, don't have the capability to move back across the river, because the bridges are blown up. Ponton bridges, they will try to bring, but just as the Russians see Ukrainians, Ukrainians see the Russians. They are not going to be able, from everything I know, to build this ponton bridges, temporary bridges, because Ukrainians have long-range weapons, and they're going to hit them. Ukrainians are not just sitting here watching Kherson being destroyed. They're fighting back. So without the bridges, they can't cross the river, which is still a wide river.
Yeah.
And they can't cross it in the boats, because everybody sees the boats. The drones are flying everywhere. You see, like, you open up the balcony door and you see drones flying, you know, the Shahid, and you see the little green light, you know, something in between a firefly and Great Gatsby, you know, the green light. So it's not as romantic. Yeah, that's the reality here. The other day I wanted a Bounty chocolate bar, and I opened, like, look through my bags, and I opened, oh, here it is. And then, oh, no, it's not. It's a piece of the Russian aerial bomb that I got from the site. So, but the drones are here, and they see what's going on. They won't let the Russian, well, not fleet, but boats of any sort cross Dnipro. The amphibian groups, you know, with the underwater scenario, very unlikely. Also, it's getting colder. It's been very, very warm, but this week it started to get colder, and eventually there will be rains, which will make every movement more difficult at the front. And then the winters are very harsh here. I've been here last winter. It's snowing, it's ice, it's very, very cold, but it's not icy enough for anybody to cross the river on feet either. So the river is really a natural obstacle, and that's why it's also difficult for Ukrainians to cross it. They have the same problems. Plus, when the Russians were retreating, they left, and it's a part of the scorched earth strategy, mines everywhere. So yeah. Everything outside of Kherson is heavily mined. When you drive across the road, you see the signs, mines, mines, mines. And it's one of the most mined areas in the world. It will take decades to demine it. I don't think the Russians will come back. So because they can't come back, they're still close enough to attack it from the air. And because the air defense can fight against the aerial bombs, it's too close to intercept it the way in Odessa or in Kyiv, when other areas, drones are being intercepted and taken down. It's more like Kharkov, where the border is so close that it's almost too late to do anything when the shell is flying towards you. So what will happen? I don't know. I think I'm convinced, knowing Ukrainians, seeing their resilience, seeing how hard they fight, and knowing how demoralized and disorganized the Russian troops are, I think eventually there will be a way to push them back. I think that Crimea will be taken. I actually don't doubt it. I just don't know when.
Yeah. Thank you for that. Now, if I'm hearing correctly, if I'm understanding it correctly, Russian troops are on basically the western side of the river as opposed to the eastern. The eastern side of the Dnipro River is the kind of landmass that comes down to Crimea. The western side is where Kherson is. Is that right? Or do I have it backwards?
Well, they call it here.
The right and the left.
Not making it clear for anyone. It's right and left.
Okay. The Russians are on the right, but now they've come over to the left and they can't get back? Is that what's happening?
No. So I'm currently on the right.
You're on the right.
The Ukrainian
okay.
neutral territory. We're on the right side of history. We're on the right side of Kherson.
Okay.
That's how it's easy to remember. The Russians are on the left side, which is east. You know, like if you look at it, this is east, this is west. Okay. So I'm on the west. Right. But they never call it this way. So, but basically, if you look at the map and you see Dnipro going up, cutting through Ukraine, that their description is clear. The right is the one leading through the land corridor to Crimea.
Okay,
that's where we have Litopol, Berdyansk. And further on, there is Zaporizhia, which is a very hot part right now as well, because that's where a lot of battles are happening. And that's where the nuclear power plant is.
Right.
And if the Russians are to use the scorched earth strategy in full, they have Zaporizhia nuclear power plant, which can be very easily turned into a dirty bomb, which they have been threatening to do all along.
Well, there's now a resolution in the U.S. government that if they do that, they activate the NATO powers, for what it's worth.
That would be lovely.
Yeah.
If the voice of reason ever resonates in Russian ears, that would be terrific.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure it does, though. So
I guess what I'm getting at is, are the Russian soldiers in Kherson trapped? Are they on the incorrect side of the river and they need to get across the river to escape? Or are they just shooting at Kherson from across the river?
No. They're not in Kherson.
Okay.
So we're talking, let's clarify. I know it's complicated, and thank you for being there. Thank you, everyone, for trying to understand. Let's get it together. So there's the city of Kherson, which was captured in the beginning of the war, and which is liberated. It was liberated almost a year ago in November 2022. The city of Kherson is in the Kherson region or Kherson Oblast. It's sort of like the city of New York in the state of New York,
right?
Yeah, so it's like an egg, the York and the egg, right?
Okay.
So the region is the white of the egg and the yellow is the city. So there are no Russian soldiers in the city of Kherson. They've been pushed back across the river. Well, imagine London, right? There's the Thames going, the Big Ben. We are on the side of Big Ben. And on the other side, there are enemies shooting at you.
Okay.
That's pretty much how it is.
Okay, gotcha. I get it now.
So Russians occupied at this moment only a part of Kherson region. And they didn't just occupy it. They called a referendum, and then they annexed this area along with Zaporizhia and Donetsk and Luhansk and pronounced it a part of Russia.
Right.
They said Russia is here forever. They said it about the city of Kherson too, but then they were kicked out in a few weeks. So that was, we know that. But they are there. The Russian soldiers are there. And that's where they fight at us, where they fire at us from. And I've been to the bank many, many times, and even recently, although it's extremely dangerous, you can't come to the water. For one thing, the journalists are not allowed to film for a good reason, so we don't go to the water. But we've been helping volunteers to deliver humanitarian aid to houses, and you see it from the window, and like from the window of our apartment, from my colleague's room, you could actually see through the river.
Okay. Now, you mentioned before the slow counteroffensive, and I want to, just pull back on a grand scale and overgeneralize here about just wars and invasions and stuff. And we knew this from the beginning. When Putin first invaded, he thought the thing was going to be over in 3 days. The soldiers that went in had like dress uniforms with them so they could have a parade in Kyiv, and they didn't have any logistical planning. So when you're invading another country, logistics, which are important in wartime anyway, I mean, more important really than anything, become even more important. And you require, an awful lot of soldiers and military forces and, logistical things that actually work in order to even hold whatever territory you take. It's not enough to just waltz in. You have to then control it forever. And it's very, very hard to do that. Just not Russia and Ukraine, just anybody, right? If you stop and think about it, Russia has not done a great job with any of these facets of things. The only advantage they have really is that they have a lot of people that they can draw from and you know, and send to their death, you know, because Putin's such a stand-up guy. He just doesn't care, you know, psychopath. So when you mention the counteroffensive and you talk before about it's not always territory on a map, it's really hitting at these logistical things. So I'm looking at, you know, that to me is why Kherson is so important, because it is a strategically an important place, because it's at the mouth of the river, which leads down to the Black Sea, and then Crimea is right there. And then I think that the Kerch Bridge, I know that they've been hitting at that. If you look at the map of Crimea, the north part, there's the little isthmus that connects it to Ukraine is on one side, and then there's a bridge sort of on the eastern side that connects it to Russia. And I'm actually surprised that bridge still exists, but they have not been able to send missiles to Crimea yet, because they don't have the capability to send them that far, as I understand it. And now the U.S. has authorized these new weapons that are coming. I don't think they're there yet, that will be able to do that. They've done some sabotage stuff in the Black Sea also. I don't know. It feels like,
well,
the slow counteroffensive feels like it's working, is my point.
Well, it is not, and I'll get back to this, the whole idea of slow, which is totally the Kremlin narrative that was planted in the Western collective media and mental place. Actually, on September 22nd, there was a second attack on the Russian Navy headquarters, which completely damaged it. It's a Russian Black Navy fleet. They have destroyed the building and most likely killed Sokolov, who was the head of the Russian Navy. Since then, there was this ridiculous video that Russians have released where a person visibly dead is sitting and not moving. And Russians are very good at it. And they never acknowledged that their generals or their commanders are killed. And this person did not appear in public after that. And I just had an interview with the press secretary of the Ukrainian Navy. It will be coming forthcoming on the Malcontent News this week. It was very, very good way he explains how the Ukrainians using their missiles, using the new low range and high precision weapons that they got from the West, and using their own drones. They have developed underwater drones and all sort of drones. They have the whole army. They destroy the Russian fleet, which has definitely lost the capacity. And also they are now afraid to approach. Before you could see them from Odessa, you could see them on the horizon, and now they're just hiding in the bays, and they lost their capacity, they lost their air defense when the Russian cruiser Moskva was downed. There was a major air defense resource. There are also things that people don't pay attention and don't understand, but there are things like the telecommunication towers of Baikonur in the Black Sea, which were recaptured, and Russians were doing their reconnaissance and intelligence work from that. They lost this capacity. But most importantly, the logistics chains. That's what I hear from every intelligent, good analyst. It's all about the logistic chains, because sure, once the Ukrainians have the long range weapons, the Russians cannot approach their targets as close anymore. They have to retreat. So like, again, in the Black Sea, there is a place called Kinburn Spit, which is a very, very fine, thin spit, like a peninsula that goes very close to the Ukrainian-controlled town of Ochakov. And so before they were able to pummel it with whatever they wanted, because it's very close. But now with this long-range weapons, the Russians can't do it anymore because they would be destroyed. So at best, they can just do a little dance when they pull their artillery there and then immediately retreat. It's very hard to do it in the sand, and especially with bad weather conditions. So once they don't have the ability to get as close to the front, they start losing.
Right.
And that's that's when the Ukrainians will systematically use the long-range, high-precision HIMARS, which they already have, and then ATMS, which will make it even easier. And also, you know, you have to understand, again, I'm not a military expert. I'm just a person who spent 2 years here, and every child here knows what I'm telling you. But when that's why I love interviewing militaries, you know, on from the States, British ones, and here in Ukraine, because they actually know what's going on.
Right.
And they explain it very, very well. And once they explain it to you, you understand that the whole concept of the speed of counteroffensive is really not even applicable here, especially when the front line is so extended.
Right. Yeah, no, that makes sense. You know, you talked about the PSYOP and that earlier that, you know, hitting Kherson and the things that they're doing is part of a PSYOP. I think the psychological impact of hitting Sevastopol, where the Russians have had a fleet in the Black Sea for a long, long time, because they leased it from Ukraine before the war even started. So they've been there since, I don't know, for a long, long time. To have that sort of stronghold penetrated and these ships go down and their naval leader or admiral or whatever he is killed is a big deal. I think that sends a message like, oh shit, we're really in trouble. They're hitting our fortresses now too. I think that's what we're going to have to, you know, look for going forward. So tell us about the Malcontent news in your podcast. And do you have like interviews lined up now down the line? You mentioned one that was going to drop this week.
Yeah, well, I have an editor, so ultimately they decide, but I have a pretty good control over it too, which I like. So far, so good. I like most of the things about it. And the quality is very good. You would appreciate it. They're very good about like no hissing, no popping. You know, I usually don't pay much attention to it, but it is important. And so it was very hard to get this interview because it's press secretary of the Ukrainian Navy. I just met him before he was that working in the field, and it goes a long way, especially when you're here in the country for a long time. You know, just come and go like a tourist, like people start to appreciate what you do. And I really enjoyed it. I had to translate it from Ukrainian into English, and the power was down and the internet was down when I was interviewing him. So it wasn't an easy process. And there was a lot of shelling, like, because I'm here in Kherson, I have all these adventurous podcasts. Like one of my interviews was interrupted by the heat in our yard. So the glass flew in the window where I was sitting. So I had to stop and I had to continue with this interview about the Polish-Ukrainian relationship in a different location. And it's like the story itself is adventurous. And for as much as I can say, I include it, you know, because we were a bit hunted here and I had to change locations. Yeah, but there are also, you know, voices from the ground. I meet a lot of people who speak English, and also I translate. By now I speak Ukrainian somewhat decently. I even was presenting on the Ukrainian television in Ukrainian, Greg. That was shameful, but they were very graceful about it. And I understand it, and I somewhat speak it, but there's ways to go. But when it comes to interviewing, I can do it, no problem. So that's an interesting one that I recommend. And there are like all kind of experts. I'm trying to find whatever is happening, to find a person who's an expert in that field. Like when there was the scandal with Yaroslav Hunka, with the SS, 98-year-old SS that was given a standing ovation in Canada.
In Canada, sure, yeah.
So I'm actually looking forward to interviewing someone this week who is a historian in Canada and an expert on Russia and Ukraine, who has a good sound view on this whole shameful experience, let's put it this way. So, you know, something that is happening, but also something to give a broader context, something to bring voices from Ukraine, because I'm not a Ukrainian voice. I'm based in Ukraine and I have a weird accent, but I am not a Ukrainian. I'm an American journalist who never got rid of the accent, folks. I don't have, oh, there was an attack on me. You would like that. There was an attack.
I do not like an attack on you. I would never like an attack on you.
That was on the internet. We all experienced that. That was on my Wikipedia page. That was very smart. I have to give it to them. Where they fixed it to make me look like a Russian writer. Well, I don't, as you know, I don't write in Russian. I don't have anything anywhere close to written or published in Russian. The closest I had was a translation of a story from English in a Kyiv magazine, in a Ukrainian magazine. So, I mean, if anybody would look into that, and I didn't see it because I don't have a habit of looking at myself, you know, like on the web. It just came up randomly, and I was shocked because that is very serious because, you know, this country is at war with Russia. If anybody actually believes I'm Russian, they would kick me out of the country. That was a very smart attack. Now fixed. But so that was apropos me not being a Ukrainian either.
Yeah.
I am an American. So the way I see my role is to bring to the audience, the global audience, not just in the West, Ukrainian voices, as many as I can.
Well, you do a great job with it. And I have to say, you know, the podcast is really nice. You did for years, you did it, you know, the literary series at the bookstore in San Francisco. And you're such a good interviewer. You're so smart and you ask such good questions. So it's really nice to see you doing that. I think we would all rather be talking about literature than cities being wiped off the face of the earth. But it is nice to see you back in that element because I think you're really good at it. And, you know, you just you bring the proper gravitas to it, I guess. You know, you treat it with the respect that it needs and the intelligence that it deserves. And, you know, it's good. It's a good thing.
I learned from the best, Greg. I learned from the best. I learned from you.
No. You were doing that before. I but thank you. Okay, we're coming up on time and I know it's very late there. So I want to ask you one more question before I release you to go to sleep, try to sleep with the bombs going off. I shouldn't even joke about that. It's really just, I can't wrap my mind around
that. That's the only way to cope with about it. Like today, Greg, can I tell you real briefly?
Yeah.
I was working all day long on the article and something else. And then I need some air. Yesterday, we were out in the field all day long and today. So I step out and there are two grandmas sitting on the bench. One is with a little doggy. And then there's another neighbor sticking out from the window on the first floor and the glass is broken. There's like, hey, Lucia, you need to tie yourself up to this bench because when the shockwave comes, you're going to fly into my window along with this bench.
That's it. It's the gallows humor. It is the only way, I think, to cope. I say from the comfort of upstate New York, far, far away from the front, you know. OK, this is my question. Now, we've been talking about Ukraine and Russia and the tensions for, you know, 2 years now, something like that, you and I, because you know, you really saw this coming and were afraid that it was going to happen. You know, you saw the signs leading up to it. So I watched you reporting on it from San Francisco, where you were monitoring the Telegram channels. And I saw when you, you know, originally managed to get to Ukraine and, you know, and I've watched you now sort of with awe cover this whole thing for as long as you have. So I guess my question is, you know, looking at it now, it's been 2 years almost of this thing that's happened. What has changed about it for you in your mind? Like what am I trying to say here? How has your view of war, of this particular war, of the people involved, how has any of it changed? How have you changed? A nice, easy question to send you off with.
Now, speaking of people asking good, deep, hard to answer questions. Change. That's, well, I mean, of course, everything has changed because before I've seen a lot of crap in my life, being from the Soviet Union and, you know, with immigration and all that. But I've never experienced war firsthand. I lived with the knowledge and the transgenerational memory of the war because all my ancestors lived and some died and perished during World War II, some in Ukraine and some in Russia. But I personally have not experienced it. And I did not imagine, as like you or anybody else living somewhere in San Francisco, you watch a movie, but you don't watch yourself being a part of it. And as we were driving yesterday through some very bad roads with the black smoke coming up, supposedly from aerial bombs, and the GPS signal was lost because it jammed there, so we didn't know where we were. And there were four block posts, and we were stopped at every single one and interrogated. And as we drive, like I tell my colleague, Paul Conroy, with whom and other team members we made Under Deadly Skies, formerly known as Eastern Front. And we're here, by the way, making a new movie, making a film about Kherson. And I said, like, well, it is like being in a movie. And he goes like, well, it's a shit movie. And that's what I can tell you. I mean, I'm quoting people today, but I'm out of words. It's a shit movie, and I wouldn't wish on anybody to be in it. On the other hand, the war, the book I'm reading, you know, we are into books, you and I. So this is a book I have been reading, among other, and it's called The War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. And it's a very interesting book by Chris Hedges. I don't agree with everything. And he's been at it, a war correspondent, for 30 years. He's been through every single war. And it's an interesting read. It's like, it's very hard to come back to peace from the war, because in the war, everything is black and white and there's good and evil. It's like Lord of the Rings, you know, yeah. There are orcs on the other side of the river. And here it's a Shire and some people are shit, but, you know, it's basically good. And we're fighting the orcs and, you know, it's easy. And then and it's dramatic. But then things are not as easy and dramatic and black and white when you go back, and things are mundane. And when I went briefly to America to attend to some logistics, it was hard. I was annoyed at things, because they were meaningless to me. And I'm concerned. I will need to do more therapy. I'm doing some already. I need to rethink everything. And I will be rethinking everything. But on the other hand, what do? As humans or as writers, we just rethinking everything every single day. And if we stop rethinking everything, we just go on.
Yeah. No, you're right. You're right about that. I'm glad to hear you're in therapy. I'm glad. I worry about you. I really do. Because you're way out there in a very dangerous place. And I just have so much admiration for what you're doing and all the work that you've done. I think you're doing great reporting and, you know, valuable from a historical standpoint, not just from the day to day, but, you know, people will look back on this years later and be able to look at the work that you have provided, you know, to help tell the story and these stories that otherwise might not get told. So, you know, I think you're doing great work. And, you know, really, I'm just in awe of every time you come on. It's just like, I can't believe you're out there doing the stuff that you're doing. So
thank you for your support, Greg. I really, really appreciate it. I really appreciate your support. It'll be support. I wouldn't be able to do what I do without it. We will all need each other. And Ukraine needs us. These people here need it. We're not doing it for our own sake. It's not like some touristy trip or in self-examination. I'm not in an ashram. The thing is, you know, these people here, they come to you and say, please tell them what's happening. And with a message like this, you know, it's very hard to say, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to do something. I'm going to write my novel, right? That's meaningless. So, you know, this one thing leads to another, and we all, trite as it is, perhaps, but we all do need each other in this world to survive. So, I mean, it's this time of the night where I start speaking in cliches. So I better get over
here. Tell everybody where they can find you, because you're still on the hell site known as Twitter.
Well, yeah, whatever the hell that thing is turning into, like, now all I don't know about everybody else, but every second tweet I see is from Elon Musk, and I never subscribe to the fellow as far as I'm concerned. And still, so I hope other people see other things. They can find me at Zarina Zabriskie, ZarinaZabriskie. And I share most of the things there, but also the Malcontent News, which is my new job, so far is very, very reliable, good source with daily reviews and interesting interviews. I still write for Byline Times. There's a film that we made, which is called Under Deadly Skies, and also known as The Eastern Front. It won very many awards by now, and it's been taken to many festivals. And soon there will be another documentary, and I will share it with everyone.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. It's always great to see you. Always great to see that you're okay. Please stay safe. Zarina Zabriskie.
Thank you, Greg.
The Prevail theme song is by Matthew Fassa. Zarina Zabriskie, Marie Cast, and Martha Acuna provided the introduction in Ukrainian, French, and Spanish, respectively. Voice talent is by Stephanie St. John and me. Thanks to Allison Gill, Molly Hawkey, Kenai Williams, Kimberly Johnson, and everyone else at MSW Media. If you'd like to support this program, get three friends to subscribe. The more downloads I get, the better the show does. You can also subscribe to the 5-8, the live YouTube show I do with my friend Stephanie Koff, a.k.a. LB. Tune in tonight for your Friday night hang. Most importantly, please subscribe to the Prevail Substack with updates every Tuesday, Friday, and Sunday. Your $6 monthly or $55 yearly subscription funds my work on the column and the podcast. Visit gregoliar.com to learn more. Thanks for listening. Drive safely. Be kind to each other. Try and enjoy yourself. And until next time, we shall prevail.
MSW Media.
Hi, I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.